Hello and welcome to the Singing Flag podcast. I'm Nicole Flattery and today I'm talking to Michael McGee about Louise Kennedy's short story, The End of the World is a Cul-de-Sac. Michael McGee is a writer from Belfast and an editor at Tangerine magazine. He is a graduate of the PhD creative writing program at Queen's University and his work has appeared in Winter Papers, The Stinging Fly and The 32, an anthology of working class writing. His first novel, Close to Home, will be published by Hamish Hamilton next April. Michael will read a short extract from the story now.
So it's the end of the world as a cul-de-sac. The dereliction was almost beautiful. The houses dark against the mauve dawn. Pools of buff-coloured water glinting briefly as a passing car took the last bend before town. Number 7 was starting to look like the other units. The lawn stringy with broken weeds. The footpath petered out and Sarah landed hard in a puddle, picking her way over broken masonry and loops of cable until she reached the end of the cul-de-sac. The noise was coming from the show house. It looked even worse inside than out. Clots of dung littered the travertine floor. All the doors had been taken, including the front one, which only seemed to emphasise how small the rooms were. The donkey was in the living room, by the cavity in the chimney breast where the granite fireplace had been. It was plump and skittish, pastels of dried sleep at the corners of its eyes. Sarah whispered to it, cajoled, pleaded. She tried shooing it, spreading her arms to drive it out to the hallway. It pawed and snattered. A flum of shit hit the wall behind it. She would have to go and get her neighbour. She left the estate and started up the steep lane towards Maddie Feeney's house. She'd gone there once with Davy when the old man's wife died. Away from the main road, the light was different. It was hard to see. The brambles that coiled back over the dry stone walls nicked her hands. She walked faster, almost trotting, her Wellingtons kicking up small rocks and squeaking over the trench of grass that ran the centre of the lane. She was breathing hard when she reached the yard. A light was on in the stables. Someone was mucking out, metal tines scraping the ground. The raking stopped. She didn't hear footsteps until they were very close. "You're up early," said a voice behind her. A man's voice, his accent local, from the town. "I can't see you," she said, turning quickly. The speaker was barely 30, with a clipped beard and hair brushed to one side. The thin electric light made him look drawn. "Did I scare you?" he said to her hands. She looked at them. They were trembling. "One of the donkeys got out," she said. She wasn't used to hearing herself speak, and her voice sounded slight, inconsequential. "Where is it?" "In the show house." "I see," he said. His eyes were laughing at her. "Should I go and tell Maddie?" "He's up in the hospital." "Is he all right?" "He had a stroke 3 weeks ago." "I didn't know. How is he?" "The speech wasn't affected. He'll be back when they finish the physio." He hooked the horse box onto an old jeep and opened the passenger door. "You might show me where the donkey is," he said. She sat beside him. There was a tree-shaped air freshener swinging from the rearview mirror, but the jeep had the sweet, gamey odour of animals. At the bottom of the lane, he glanced up and down the road, his eyes lingering on her when he looked left. "Ryan is my name," he said. "Sarah." "I know," he said. "You're the gangster's mole from down the hill." "Is that what they call me?" "I'm after thinking of it now." She got out by the entrance and unchained the gate, swinging it open to let the jeep in. Ryan pulled in beside a dome of polished granite that had been sandblasted with the words "Hawthorne Close" in a Celtic font that Sarah had thought at the time might tempt fate. Not that she had told Davy so. Morning had broken. Under the low cloud, the sunflower yellow paint on the houses appeared noxious. "I thought the place looked bad from the road," he said. She followed him to the show house. He sidestepped the shit and stood in the kitchen. There wasn't much left of it. Mould-speckled French grey paint, dangling wires, buckled skirting boards and sawn-off pipes. A few days before Davy left, a contractor had called to their house and accused him of stripping the place himself, selling the fittings on the sly. Sarah had run the man from the door. Now she was inclined to believe him. Ryan went into the living room. He ruffled the donkey's mane. "All right, buddy," he said. "I didn't know what to do," said Sarah. "I think I just frightened him." He gave its arse a slap. The animal shimmied and clapped, then began to move, colliding with walls and door frames, reeling back before Ryan got it out the front. He jollied and pushed it across the hardcore, leaning his weight on it to get it into the horse box. He secured the door and put his hands on his hips. "Fuck's sake," he said, the words leaving his mouth like steam. "I can close the gate after you and walk up." "I said I'd drop you home," he said, getting into the jeep. Sarah understood. He was offering her a lift because he wanted to see the house. Everyone wanted to see the house. Strangers rang the bell on vague pretexts, selling calendars, asking for directions, straining their necks to look into the hall when Sarah opened the door, walking around the side for a view of the housing estate her husband had thrown up and abandoned to her. Ryan waited while she locked the gate. She sat back in the passenger seat and he watched her pull the safety belt across herself. They only had 200 yards to travel, but it made her feel bolstered, held in place. Her driveway bent up in an arc that mirrored the line of the floating wall at the front. The horseshoe swung left and right, horse box swung left and right, and Ryan had the lock, hard to park. She opened the front door. Bills and flyers were strewn across the entrance hall. The art was gone, lifted off the walls by the owner of the gallery on a tip-off from the architect. Davy had taken the buffalo hide he had bought when he went to the Super Bowl. It was the only thing he took with him. "Some spot," Ryan said. His voice was still wobbling in the high, empty space as they entered the kitchen. "Coffee?" she asked. "Aye, go on." She filled the kettle and got out mugs and a jar of instant granules. He moved around the room, taking it in. The dining table was glass and chrome and surrounded by 12 curved white chairs. A globular light fitting was suspended above it, a spiky metal Telstar sort of thing. The kitchen units were at floor level only, high gloss white with walnut counters. Sarah had had no hand in the decor. Davy had said it was the architect's job. A vast patio door, bleared with dust, ran the length of the dining table. Ryan tried the handle. "Put it right up till it clicks," said Sarah. He opened the lock and slid it across until it vanished into the wall. The room filled with autumn. You could see over Maddie's place and across the glen to the mountain. It was like being outside. He leaned in the doorframe and lit a cigarette. His shoulders were taut, as though he was trying to look smaller. The beard both became him and made him unremarkable. Sarah handed him his coffee. He lifted the mug to his mouth and swallowed. He pulled a face and inclined his head at the Bakelite coffee machine that was plumbed in near the sink. "How come I got the cheap shit?" "You can only get the pods online." "So get them online." "My cards were cancelled." He stepped onto the patio and Sarah followed him around to the west side of the house. She stood behind him as he looked down the garden. Terraces of shrubs were grown thickly all the way down to the wire fence. The spherical shape the gardener had once imposed on the box trees blurred with new shoots, the lavender silvery and woody and still flowering. Hawthorn Close was beyond it, lollipop shaped. 12 semi-detached houses either side of a track that led to 5 detached houses around the bulb of the cul-de-sac. From here you could see things you couldn't see from the road, that one of the units had been occupied, that someone had tried to tame a garden and make a home, that the granite dome which read Hawthorn Close had been deposited onto a furry fort, that beside the dome a tree had been torn down, its roots leaving deep velvety furrows which seemed to bulge when light fell across them. Imagine living there, he said, turning to look at her. Sarah went back into the kitchen. He followed her in and opened the fridge. It was empty except for rose noir nail polish, skimmed milk and a prune yogurt. He closed it again. Do you want to get out of here later? Get a drink or something? He said. I don't know. I'll come back at 7, he said. He poured his coffee into the sink and left through the hall. She stood at the front door to see him off. He opened his window and adjusted his wing mirror. He was looking at her as he drove away. After he left, she tied her hair up. She swept the floor. She wiped down all the surfaces in the kitchen and washed and dried the dishes. She closed the patio door and spread a section of the glass with green liquid she found in the utility room. She wiped it with newspaper and stood back. It looked worse than before. She spread the dining table and began buffing, rubbing round and round until the paper disintegrated. She cleaned the sink with bleach and mopped the tiles. She went to the garden with a prune yogurt and a teaspoon. She sat on a metal deck chair and ate, sucking the spoon clean after each mouthful. A car pulled in by the gate of the estate. The driver got out. He had greased back, red hair and an off-the-rack suit. He stuck his phone through the railings to take photographs. Before he drove off, he made a call, his voice indistinct. He was probably from the bank or from a firm of solicitors acting for a contractor who was owed money. The reporters had stopped coming, although she feared they would return after the inquest. She ran her wedding finger around the inside of the pot and licked it. Her rings were loose. Her skin tasted of sour milk and chlorine and green apples. At least the place was clean. Maybe she should clean herself up too, in case Ryan came back. She went inside. She had started sleeping in the boot room Davy had built off the kitchen for their sons to use after football training. The arrogance seemed spectacular now. They didn't have sons or daughters. The morning they found the body, Sarah had abandoned the master bedroom and dragged the mattress downstairs. Now she lay every night under the high, shallow window with the white blind. There were grey stone slabs on the floor. The modular shelving that ran along one wall was empty. It resembled a clinic you saw on television where rich women went to lose weight or go mad. She shampooed her hair and smeared the contents of a sample sachet of conditioner onto the ends, twisting it in a coil on the crown of her head. She shaved her legs and underarms. She hesitated, then soaped between her legs, dragging the razor from back to front until her pubic hair lay in fuzzy clumps in the plug hole. She wrapped herself in a towel and sat on the toilet seat with a magnifying mirror and tweezers, pulling black hairs from her moustache and eyebrows. The tubes and bottles of makeup in the bathroom cabinet were marked to be used within 6 months. They had gone off, like the prune yogurt. She took out makeup brushes she had bought in sex on Fifth Avenue after a boozy lunch for €314, and applied liquids and gels and powders. When she was done, her skin was bronzed and dewy, her eyes dark and wide. She blow-dried her hair and wound it around electric rollers. When she was dressed, she made a cup of tea and brought it outside. She sat in the metal deck chair again, a Missoni scarf on her head to hold the rollers in place, and waited.
Thank you, Mick.
All good?
Yeah, really good. Very well read.
Thank you.
Yeah. I never thought about makeup going off before. That's something
new
for me.
Thing that happened.
Something new for me to be concerned about. So that was from Louise Kendi's The End of the World is a Cul-de-Sac, and it was from her collection, but the Stinging Fly published it first. Can you talk to me a little bit about this story and what it's about and why you chose it?
It's about this woman who's sort of been abandoned by her fella, who's got himself into what seems to be a bit of debt. And as the story sort of unfolds, you sort of learn a bit more about what is going on. He's thrown up this cul-de-sac of houses and what seems to be like a rural setting in the hope of building them quickly and selling them quickly and making money, probably to pay off debts that he's owed to people who you don't really want to owe money to. At least that's the kind of suggestion that comes towards later in the story. And so she's sort of in this house. It's kind of an extravagant Celtic tiger sort of house, you know, with the boot room for kids that they don't have, and, you know, sliding doors and patios and all this kind of thing. And she's been there for what seems to be a long time. I mean, her makeup has went off, so we're going to fairly assume that, you know, she hasn't left the house too much, and has been, sort of abandoned alone with very little in the way of money. And then she has to clear this donkey out of one of the houses, I guess, because she's probably looking out, sort of trying to maintain the houses in some way, regardless of the fact that they've fallen into disrepair. And then she meets this fella, Ran, who's like a very interesting character and sort of a guy who you don't quite know what his intentions are. And as the story goes on, we learn a bit more about who he is or who he might be. Mm-hmm. And I think the thing that Sarah suddenly realizes is that he's the kingpin in the tabloid newspapers, you know. And so it's a story about her being in a place that she's kind of estranged from in some way and is very alone and is sort of goes for dinner with this fella. You know, he sort of takes her out for a bit of grub, takes her to a restaurant, and it's a sort of, you know, he sort of takes control and orders her food and her drink for her, and there's these sort of vague red flags, and then we sort of it sort of gets to the end of the story, and then you realize what actually happened on this site, in this cul-de-sac, which is that, you know, his Davy, her husband's, sort of persuaded her sister and brother-in-law to move into one of the houses, thinking that if one of them did, that then other people would come and buy them quickly. But the houses were so terrible and fallen into such disrepair and so badly built. I guess that might have something to do with it, but that one morning her brother-in-law is found sort of hanging from a furry tree, you know, and this provokes great scandal locally, which is part of the reason why she's kind of driven into this isolation, you know, that she's both been abandoned by her husband, but is also living in a place where she clearly isn't from.
Yeah.
And she's sort of, and the locals are, you know, they're sort of like, mm-hmm. you know, who is this? And
yeah.
So she kind of, you know, goes further into herself, you know, almost to the point of like, you know, never really appearing in public. I think she goes to like a gas, 24-hour gas station to buy her supplies, which are toiletries and ham, you know, because money is a slip, you know.
Yeah. And what was it about this story in particular that of all the stories?
I read a few stories and I read around, and I remember reading this story when it was published in this thing of life. I think it was like a 2017, so it was before 2018 maybe. So it was before the book was out, the collection.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd read like some of Louise Abbott, you know, kept abreast of Louise's stories around that time.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember this one just being like, it really stuck with me, like, because for all sorts of reasons, like, I think it does what Louise Kennedy does so well, in that she withholds so much. She does not tell you anything, and only in snippets.
Mm-hmm.
So the actually what happens, the story is like an exercise in constraint, you know? And then as it progresses and as it gets towards the end of the story, the sort of picture becomes clearer. And I think just on that level, it's a really beautiful piece of work, like, you know.
I think this story has something that I love what I think all good stories have, which is I feel like more has been cut than a lot has been cut. She probably wrote a lot of it, or maybe even like wrote a flashback and cut it all, which is great.
Yeah.
And another thing, which I feel like it has in common with Trespasses, is her kind of use of dialogue, which I think is great in this story.
It's I think like it's an interesting, because I don't think any story, I don't know, I can't remember the rest of her collection, but she very usually uses the first person.
Mm.
She feels a lot more comfortable in the third, and I think, and she's really good at that. I think I think it's like really hard to write third person.
I agree.
Who writes exclusively in first?
Yeah, same. Yeah.
You know, it's like it's something about that distance and managing that distance that she's she makes the third person feel really close. She's really good at that sort of free and direct style. And a lot of that has to do with her voice and that sort of intimacy of voice that she has.
I think the third person works brilliantly here because it's almost like you're watching her, Sarah, through the windows of this like horrible rundown kind of place.
And I think like it feeds into the estrangement as well of the story, you know, and that like she's in this environment that isn't hers in a way, you know, she's kind of just in this fucking empty house surrounded by empty houses in a countryside that's pretty empty. And it's kind of just this like rings of isolation, just like all around her, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
So the third person kind of works for that in a way.
I primarily write in first person. I've written in third person. I'm trying to write something in third person right now. And you write a lot in first person, Mick.
I'm also like writing a short story in third present at the minute, just to see if and I think I'm doing it in present because the past third just scares me. You know? Just like early.
Yeah, yeah.
So the present sort of allows me the closeness, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And it's an interesting sort of I want to be able to write in it. And I think like reading Louise, people like Louise, and like it's sort of, you're sort of, there's just seeing how, I think it is all about that narratorial distance, or like between the narrator and the story itself that's interesting.
Something I thought about in this story, and also I was thinking about your work because I'm one of the lucky few that have read your upcoming novel. But it's something you and Louise both kind of do really well, is you write very much in the present moment. Like this story is very much moves just, you know, she's in the house, she's at the restaurant. There's no like big flashbacks or things like that. Is that something that you like to do in your own work as well?
I think so, especially with I think it depends from piece to piece, really. Like, I think like it depends on. I think one of the things that I particularly, we're writing first person, and even in the stories I've published in Sting and Fly, it's always been a close first. There's very little in the way of retrospective distance, you know, that they're not sitting, you know, at some point in the future, recounting a story from like, and I don't know why that is. I guess there's like, I kind of like the immediacy of voice. I like being able to like feel like you're pulling the reader through this character's world, or you're seeing the world very closely through the narrator's eyes, and almost experiencing the story as it happens in the present. Do you know, in the fictive present or whatever. So, and I think that it may be just to do with the like brevity, you know, and I think like a lot of the story writers who I really like, well, saying that, like there's a lot that contradict this statement massively, but like I think my sort of early influences were all the kind of minimalist American writer, and I think like it's fucking hard to come out from under those. Do you know, they're kind of lost, they're like my stylistic kind of. Like, and or even though, like, you know, like there's like, I love Alice Munro, who isn't like that. Even Flannery O'Connor isn't really like that. You know, it's probably that generation. Like, it's probably all those fucking writers who read German creative writing, I mean, you know, like Carver and fucking Hemingway and all them dudes. Even like Laurie Moore, I think like she's very pared down and very concise in her sentences. Like, but those are the kind of writers that sort of are my sort of foundation, I think.
Something you said before this, we started talking on the podcast, was you think the story is kind of why it works so well, and I agree with you, is it feels sort of like it's whispered to you, like a little bit like gossipy, like she is telling you, and I think that's really hard to pull off in a short story, like she's telling you a secret, you're sort of leaning in or
listening. It's that thing of like, because it always, I actually never really, I only really thought about this whenever I was rereading that story, and I've read it, you know, a few times over the last few days just to sort of get my head around it. And, you know, that sort of, it reminds me of like what Frank O'Connor tries to do in his stories, and that like his are kind of voice-driven stories. He speaks about the importance of the voice and of making the reader feel like they have to lean in to listen. Mm. You know, he has that thing of like, you know, you want the story to feel like you're sitting on the end of a bar with someone mm-hmm. who's telling you a story. And yeah, it's sort of like, you know, come here, do you hear us? You know, come here, do you hear us? And I feel like that's what Louise Kennedy does. It's that kind of, you're sort of hanging on to the end of every sentence, even in the sort of most mundane sort of scenes. Because a lot of that was just her cleaning the house and then like, you know, you know, plucking hers out of her eyebrows and mustache. Yeah. You know, like that's kind of, that's it. And yet there's so much weight behind those them sequences of action, you know?
Yeah. Oh, no, absolutely. I was thinking, because I've read Trespassers as well, and I feel that it's funny to kind of read this after, because in both Trespassers and the story, the main character is quite conscious of being watched. They're being watched by the townspeople. They're being watched by the whole community. There's a lot of observation happening, and there's kind of self-monitoring happening because of that. And I found that really interesting. And it's something I noticed a little bit in Close to Home. Is it something you think about in your own work?
Always. You know? No, I mean, yeah. It's the kind of, I don't know. I mean, I guess it must come from, or at least like has its seeds in coming from a place where everybody knows everything about your business. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Everybody knows everything. And or at least actually you're constantly trying to think about, or constantly worry of what other people are thinking or saying or how your actions will have like consequences in a sort of broader context, you know.
Yeah.
Why Trespass is as good as what it is, because it's sort of, the stakes are really high, you know, like in a way that's kind of hard to get your head around from this context. Like, you know, that there's so much risk involved and you know, just it's a story between two people who fall in love. Mm-hmm. They're just at opposite sides of this what people call a divide. It's just like, you know, isn't actually much of a divide at all, but
in
context of historical conflict, it is, like, you know. Mm-hmm. So I think like she's very preoccupied, and even throughout the collection of stories as well, there's this degree of self-surveillance and constant worry. And I think it is that thing of, I think, like, interestingly, in the collection of stories that she wrote, like, a lot of the characters are in places that they're kind of not supposed to be in, or sort of estranged from, you know. And I think that's like something that she's kind of constantly thinking about and constantly working through, and what it means to put yourself under that surveillance, what it does to your mental health, or like yourself, your being. Like.
Yeah.
I think I've done that a little bit in my book. Particularly because that's a sort of, you know, the character is, you know, he moves back and forth between these different worlds, these kind of social worlds. So when he moves out of the place that he's most comfortable in, he sort of becomes wary of himself, you know, or conscientious. Self-conscious, sorry. And I think that happens, you know, when you're in an environment that you're not, you know, you're not used to, just suddenly everything about you is much louder, you know?
Yeah. Like, oh, absolutely.
You know?
Yeah.
It's like, I'm like, an accent or voice has a lot to do with that, the way you carry yourself. Like, you never feel more like you're from Belfast when you're not in Belfast, you know? Because you hear your voice and you go, oh, fuck, I have this accent. Do you know what I mean? But yeah, I think that's...
And you're constantly, I kind of think, making decisions based on what people think you will do, and you can see that in the story. It's quite funny where she's kind of sort of towards the end of the dinner leans into this idea of her being this gangster's girlfriend, because that's what people want her to do, or she thinks that they want her to do. Another thing I think Louise does really brilliantly, and it's something that she just uses like names of things really well and stuff, but she also is very good at like revealing class through just like the most minor of kind of details and interactions, even at that dinner table. Is that something you think about kind of in your own work, how to do that subtly, and how people interact in that kind of way?
Oh yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, like,
there's brilliant bits of that in Close to Home. I don't want to ruin it.
I think Louise does it brilliantly in the story. Actually, I think that, and it's very interesting, because there's things that she says in the story that are very, like, you know, she calls the country Bopkins or something. She's very disparaging of the
character,
as the character would be, because, you know, sort of she's being isolated by them, or at least as being like And that bit in the restaurant where she thinks that all the attention is being paid to her is just because she's completely misreading the situation. Yeah. And she's like, oh, they've seen me in the paper and the scandal that, you know, and almost it does lean into it. Like when really they're actually looking at the guy she's with.
Yeah. For this. But also she is totally the person she is. Like she is that person who probably perceived herself to be like way more glamorous than everyone else in that restaurant. Yeah. And like, you know, she had the shopping trips to New York. She had all this stuff. And now she can hardly cope with the new person.
She's lived. And that's like, it must have been a mad existential moment for people.
Yeah, yeah.
Like had all this abundance. And living these ridiculously extravagant lives, you know, going to this Saxon Fifth Avenue and spending $314 on a lunch and then, you know, going to the Super Bowl, you know, Irish people going to the Super Bowl, you know, like, what is it, you know?
Does seem so absurd.
You know what I mean? It's like that Tommy Tiernan thing, do you know, when he talks about Irish people first going skiing, like, what has the world come to? Like, this, when did this happen?
And then skiing just seemed like a step too far.
It's like we need to stay in our stations, you know. And then that's what's so good about the story is that it's tapping into all that with a very subtle and gentle hand. I mean, the opening image of the donkey in the house is perfect, really. Like the walls of this house, this ghost estate, these houses that are never going to go anywhere.
Yeah, we're
essentially just built for the sake of built. Being built, you know.
But she's very good at gender kind of relations too, which is like him presuming that, you know, he can order for her and, you know, and her not like correct. It's a very good date. she plays it very well.
Brilliant, because like it's again, like it's that kind of written, she refuses to reveal too much about what's happening. Yeah. And you sort of get, is there a bigger red flag in the world than someone ordering food and drink for you? You know, I mean, like, what is, and like, and she sort of goes along with it and you can kind of sympathize with why she does. Because she has been alone for so long. Mm-hmm. This is like the first moment of like human contact I think she's had in a while. And she's very vulnerable and hungry. She's hungry. Like she's literally like her roots are falling off her fingers, you know? So,
and she's probably the kind of person who likes someone making decisions for her. That was my immediate.
That's the other thing, isn't it? Like, and that's kind of where the story goes, you know.
Yeah.
Where it's kind of like he's coming back, you know. Mm. He sort of goes back to your house, and even the way he moves in the house, you know, it's almost like it's his house already. You know, he's already picking that up. And by the end of the story, you're kind of like, oh God, like. And you can see it, you know, you can sort of see. And I mean, I don't presume the thing, you know, I'm never going to, you know, that thing about him being like a kingpin or whatever, I don't presume to think that he's a bad person. But, you know, these kind of presumptions you have about people are sort of working in the back of your head, like, you know, and those little flags are being waved. So
it's one of those, like, I think very few stories do this, but when I read it and then I finished reading it and you come to certain conclusions or whatever and then you go back, I reread it and I was like, of course, like it's all there, like all the psychology of it, it's already there. And every single kind of thing that makes up is in their first meeting, which is sort of like, you know, when you meet a person and then they do something later and you're like, it was already kind of there. And I think only really good stories make you want to read it like two or three times to kind of confirm that, you know.
That's because I think like the first time I read it, I was kind of like, what the fuck, what's going on?
Yeah.
You sort of have you have to go. I think it does merit rereading. And I think it's like it would be a brilliant story to like teach people, like young, like, you know, I think like that would, because it's a it's a brilliant, that like it's just the way of withholding.
Yeah,
he sort of, you know, and as you said, like he's feel like there's probably been a lot cut, you know, and what remains unsaid is as important as what's said, like, you know.
I was gonna say, so we were talking about the Celtic Tiger there, and I don't think about the Celtic Tiger in my own work, but it's asked about to me like quite frequently, or was. And I think it's only because like there's so much like unemployment and stuff in my book. But like I feel I only wrote about unemployed people because I knew a lot of unemployed. I was one. So of course I was gonna write about that stuff, but I'm never like I was writing about the Celtic. This is my story about the Celtic Tiger. This is my story about. And I want to ask you: do you feel similarly? Do you want to write about certain things, or do you feel like it all arises from like a certain personal place or like circumstances or whatever?
I think it can be a mixture of. It's a mixture of both, really. Like you know, you sort of. I think it's interesting even to talk about the Celtic Tiger because it sort of happened before. I was old enough to know what it was, do you know?
Me too.
Like we got the tail end. We got the crash. Yeah. Do you know? Like we got
the worst bit.
You know, we turned 17, 18 and everything got fucked. You know, like that was the kind of, we didn't get to enjoy it, you know?
I think I had like very good, like teenage years, like, you know, like there's more like lip gloss available in Ireland than there used to be.
I think like early teenage, really like, we were okay. And then the crash happened and then everything changed. But I do, I think, like, I think, I think you kind of start, I think, or at least I do, I sort of start with the character, you know? That's kind of the beginning. You start with the character and the voice and it's usually just a little snippet of something or other. The rest all just sort of comes along as you're writing. I think it's interesting to sort of, thinking about the individual and then the broader kind of structural social structures around them. It's, and I do think about that when I was writing the novel. That I was very much looking at the protagonist as like a sort of social agent, you know. But that was after time or during the process of writing it. I was sort of had to think. You almost had to, you know, unlearn a lot because remember that this character doesn't know the things that you know. You know, when you sort of...
Absolutely,
it's a process of forgetting, really, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And, you know, your novel is coming out next year. Like, I have to remind you every now and again, just in case you're not nervous enough. I'm like, well, it's coming out anyway. It'll be reviewed and people have opinions about it. but do you feel like right now, because you're probably going to get this question a lot or some question like this, but it's, you know, writing from the north of Ireland has become like... You know, it's having a moment. And it feels like to me, you know, there's a lot of grouping together of work that is like largely different. Like you know, so how do you feel about that kind of categorization or categorization of writing in general?
It's interesting, isn't it? I think there is, it is interesting that there's this moment as well, like, you know, I think like even 5 years ago, maybe, there wasn't much in the way of, I mean, there was things people were writing and really good writers. I know lots of really good writers up here, but it's been the last like year or two that things, there's been a different, people have been paying attention to the six counties in the way they weren't before, you know, even across the water. I think like fucking 5-10 years ago, if you had a pitched the novel to any British publisher that was, you know, about the north, they'd be like, get that. Do you know what I mean? They really didn't want to, at least that was my feeling about it. But I think because of the big change in the shift in the political landscape and how, you know, our good friend Brexit came to fucking change everything and just also I think they're also far enough away from, you know, it's been 24 years since the Good Friday Agreement. So it's a significant amount of time. And so sometimes, you know, you need that sort of distance to be able to, for people then to be able to wrap their heads around it in a different way, you know. And I think like, in terms of like writing, there's, I don't know how, I mean, the thing is like, I would never call myself Northern Irish, you know, I mean, that goes against my politics and also what my kind of, I see myself as an Irish person and that's my, you know, and that's my right. but it's probably unavoidable that someone at some point is going to call me a Northern Irish writer. It's going to be, and I'm going to have to just take it, you know what I mean? Or at least, you know, I'll try and kick up a fuss as much as I can. But, do you know what I mean? Like, and oh God, I've got the essay, don't you worry, man.
Straight away, you know? As soon as they do it.
And it's a complicated thing because... Yeah. And I think, you know, it has a lot to do with, like, even how people view the North and the South. Mm. And it is, it has this kind of, the psychology of partition exists across Ireland, you know. And so these categorizations happen.
Mm-hmm.
And similarly across the water, you know, the vast majority of English people couldn't point out the six counties on a map, like, you know, but you know, they don't know what the crack
That's
is.
That's very true.
It's kind of inevitable. If in an ideal world, people would just say, you know, this Irish writer, Michael McGee, and I'd be like, yes, that's fine. But you know, you can't. But in terms of like the stuff that's coming out here, it is like, it's interesting because there is some brilliant, brilliant writers like Wendy Erskine's fantastic, Lucy Caldwell's knocking around, John Carson. They're all very, very different writers right now, very, very different things, particularly different social, coming from like different social positions and writing about different milieus.
Mm.
And Louise, I count Louise as a writer from the Six Counties just because, I want her to be from up there. She has, which is interesting because I think Louise, so much of her characters are estranged from their environment. And I think that's because in a way she has been.
And
I think that moved south when she was young. I remember talking there one time and she says that the accent in her head, she has more than accent, you know, which is really interesting. And people always mistake her from being from the North, just like through her writing. And that they think they hear the Northern accent in her sentences, which is really interesting. But it's interesting because all these writers are all brilliant, but they're constantly lumped together, you know. And it's probably the same. It's the same, with Irish writing's interesting like that because you go across the water, suddenly it's Irish writing, and it's like my goodness, like and I don't know how productive it is to do that. Say that writers from the six counties don't have lots of things to talk to about each other, about their work and how it's similar and diverges from each other and all that sort of thing. But I think it's more interesting, you know, because it's always that sort of thing. It's like, now here's the event for our Northern compatriots, you know,
I get the art of the short story.
You get the short story, you know. You're fucking shoehorned. And sometimes it works really well. I think there's instances where it's interesting to talk about that and what it means to be a writer from here. But like, you know, I'm fully prepared for that as well. I feel like I'm probably going to be lumped in a lot with people from up here, and that's okay. But like, at some point, I think when it comes to that sort of thing, it's interesting to pair people together who are from different fucking places in terms of their writing and to see what commonalities are. And also just to talk in terms of, you know, the stuff itself, you know.
Totally. Like several of the books I've read in the last year have been by, you know, Wendy and Louise and Susie Dickey, and But to me, like, I would never pair Susie and another one of those writers because her work is so entirely different, you know? Like, I think it's a strange one for all to lump them together. But yeah.
It is a trend. I mean, like, even if you go back to, like, the poetry sort of thing where, you know, poetry's, you know, you can't fucking spit without landing on a poet up here. But it's like, you go back to, like, Heaney and Mahon and all them boys, you know, the kind of... They're always these, like, they're all sort of lumped together. Heaney, Lump, Mahon. Then you've Muldoon, Maeve, and Frank Ormsby and stuff. Like, these groups that emerge in different things, and they're always kind of talked about in the same way. And I don't know.
Do you feel like it affects, like, your work or how you think about your work? Because I don't ever walk around thinking like, I'm an Irish writer. I'm an Irish woman writer, under 35, just about now. Like, I'm a short story writer. I feel like, so when you sit down at the desk, do you think about these
if
things?
If anything, I'm trying to write against it. Do you know what I mean? Yeah. Like, you're trying to sort of push against it. And because I think that's what I've tried to do in the novel, at least, is to try and like write against the received opinions of what it is to be from the place that I'm from. And there's a lot of stuff, preconceptions about what West Belfast is. Mm. And I guess I was sort of writing in opposition to that. And not at the time, though. Like, I feel like at the time of writing, you're just trying to fucking write something good. You know, you're just trying to make the sentences work, you know. Beyond that, it's only sort of retrospectively whenever you can sit down and go, what was I doing? You know, and then you start thinking in them terms.
Yeah. But I think, like we were saying, I think when you write third person, you get that little bit of distance. Like, neither you or I were reading that story being like, that's Louise Kennedy. But as you write, if you write first person, like you have, for instance, or you get attached to your narrator.
Oh, yeah. It's
all the time, isn't it? Yeah.
Like, especially for women writers. I mean, I think like, you know, you use that eye and immediately you're the character, aren't you?
Yeah.
And I think and that's something and maybe that's like Louise's whole game, you know, it's just like,
I'm not going to hear that.
You're not confused. And it's interesting because like the trespasses is the third person but there's, you know, it's set in this family bar. And of course, Louise has spoken publicly about her family bar that was blown up by twice, I think, actually, back in the 70s, you know, but these connections the third person allows for a lot more to sort of, you're sort of like not in tied up in it in the same way as you would have from the eye.
I got like, even though like, people would be like, oh, this obviously happened to you. And I'd be like, do you read this story? This did not happen to me.
You were going with a comedian at one point? Is it Tommy Tiernan?
Just start telling someone. Oh, it's Tommy Tiernan, but like, the other thing I want to ask you about, because speaking of the first person, is that I know you're a big fan of Annie Ernaux.
Oh, why?
As am I. And I just like to ask you why that is, or what kind of... She won the Nobel. I don't know if you heard.
Oh, fuck, aye. She did, didn't she? I've been saying it for years, mate. I've been like, she's got to win this year, you know. Disappointed, fuck's sake. But she's great. I came to Annie Ernaux through... actually, I was like doing the PhD in Queens and was... I sort of fell in there accidentally, like, you know, as you kind of do, you know, you read something that sort of points you in that direction. And I read, read Didier Eribon's book, Returning to REM, which is sort of the memoir of social mobility and about his sort of trajectory from being like a working class kid to being an academic who wrote sort of the most, like, sort of the best autobiography. Not the best, the most eminent biography of Foucault, and became like this queer theorist and sort of talks about that trajectory. And it was beautiful and sort of blew everything open for me, you know, and because he was talking very exclusively about experience that I was sort of going through as well, of like, you know, coming from where I came from and then moving through this kind of higher education and sort of cultivating all these sort of cultural markers that you do and also the sort of weird tension within yourself when that happens. And through him, I think he mentions Annie Ernaux a couple of times in that book. And I think at that time, The Years was just published by Fitzcarraldo. And I remember like people reading it and being like, this is fucking this stuff. Like, I read The Years was the first one I read, and which was a strange way to go about it, because in terms of like the things that she's written, that's like a completely different thing to what it did in her earlier, or at least like her middle phase of work. I remember reading that and just being totally bowled over by it. And then I sort of just became obsessed. I went back and read everything from her first novel and right through to her most recent works. And I think it was that thing of there was nobody that had written the way she had about something an experience that was so close to my own, regardless of the fact that her experience of it was like in the 60s in rural France, you know, that that it spoke very directly to that tension within yourself, you know, when you move between different social worlds and what what you lose on the way, you know, and she's interesting as well because like her first book was a novel, or at least was much more novelistic in terms of how it was written compared to her third, fourth, and fifth books. You know, those kind of a man's place, a woman's story, and particularly those two, they were the kind of moment where she changed her style and started using a sort of more concise, objective voice. Almost, and she sort of describes it herself as being a sort of social scientist in the way she thinks about writing, or at least as she wants to write from as objective a position as possible, you know. But no, and that sort of it changed everything for me when I read them books, and because it spoke directly to my experience, but also just in terms of like how you think about it and how you talk about it, and that language of class, and how you cultivate that language, you know, for reading sort of the theoretical stuff, you know.
I think it's I've read some things of hers, and I think it's like that's something that you said there that, you know, in social mobility, when you move, you lose something as well. And I feel like that isn't acknowledged often enough. She's one of the few writers, I think, that really...
Does. And how that intersects in terms of gender and sexuality and she's been doing this from the 60s, like, you know, and... it's interesting now that she's getting the accolades that she is, you know, that I think for a long time, even in France, she was like kind of... she wasn't appreciated among academic circles, but she was commercially like very successful. You know, she was a big selling author for years, but she wasn't taken very seriously by academic circles, which speaks to, you know, the sort of French theoretical sort of thing that, you know, they talk about class and they sort of roll their eyes. They're like, what the fuck? Grow up. Recrypt, will you? I love her. I really do. Yeah. I think she's incredible. I was buzzing. Like.
Yeah. Oh, really? But she uses the I very well. It's coming back to the first person. I just read The Diaries, A Simple Passion. They're the diaries, yeah. And she's using the I in a way that kind of sometimes that you find sort of, well, certainly maybe in that book, like a little bit like, oh, like you sort of... turn away from like a little bit, and it's quite challenging to read that book, you know, and it reminded me of what first person can do when it's used really, really well. You shouldn't be comfortable with the first person sometimes.
That's great. I think that book's because it's that the Simple Passion's the one she's having she's going with a younger guy, isn't it? And
and it's the diaries, and it's very honest. As in, like, I think if you were to have this sort of love affair and you were to sit down and write a diary of it, this is what everyone's diary would read like. But then if you were to publish it, you go back and put in the bits where you were really cool and he was really lame, and you know, that kind of stuff.
Yeah, you sort of favor yourself in a way. It's and I think that's kind of her project, you know. And she's, the thing is, she's been writing about the same stuff her whole literary careers, from her first everything that she's ever said was written in her first novel. It's a mad, like, it cleaned out, you call it, like a lot of the things that everything, like, it's almost like she's constantly excavating and constantly questioning memory as well, which is what the eye does. Like, the eye is never stable, do you know? And she's constantly questioning that eye and questioning who she was at that point in her life and the distance between herself now and who she was then. And so it's a weird sort of, it can be a very intrusive eye and a very uncomfortable eye, because everything's questioned, you know?
I think that's what when the first person's really working, I think that's what it does really, really well, you know? Like it makes you question kind of everything and memory. And I really felt that in your novel, and that's when it works better than
Because so much, because the book, you know, because the book's about this guy who assaults somebody at a house party, isn't it? Like he punches somebody after and sort of knocks him out. And so much of that's like a process of denial, you know, he's sort of denying.
And someone lying to themselves.
The difficult thing is then like, how do you do that without feeling like you're cheating in some way, you know? Or, you know, because it's always like constantly withholding, but then also trying it's a difficult balance to get, I think, you know, you're trying not to say too much, and whenever you have something to say, you're kind of saying something that's a delusion, you know, or it's like you're saying something that the narrator's sort of trying to justify, you know.
Yeah.
I think like if you do it well, like Louise has in this story, it's sort of you see the points, you know, the little dots that are being connected through the story that are building up this sort of image or this thing, yeah.
I just want to ask you before we go about your own kind of writing. I know you've been writing for a while, like years. I met you years ago for the first time.
No,
but I had like, how do you feel now that the novel's, you know, going out in the world? Your novel is coming out next year.
So is yours.
Now. I'm the host here. But I just like, you've been, how do you feel like your writing has changed? Or was there something that you felt like you were saying about Annie Ernaux in her first book? She was still trying to get at the same things. But did you feel in the novel that you were getting closer in a way that you hadn't in your previous work?
The novel was like, you know, came about sort of haphazardly and as they do, you know, you don't really know you're writing one until you're into it. It's coming out and it's going to be in April, isn't it? So it's like 4 months, which feels like a long enough time away, but really isn't, considering, you know, it's been a year since it got accepted for publication, and that feels like it's skated by pretty quickly.
Yeah.
So you're suddenly having to think about it in terms of how you're going to talk about it in the sort of public domain, interviews or panels or whatever. And so you have to sort of start thinking about it as this other thing. It's mad sort of, I don't know, like you spend so long doing this, and the last thing on your mind is what you're going to talk about on a panel. Have to sort of start thinking about how you're going to articulate your experience of writing it, and also what you were trying to do, which then you're sort of put in this position where you're saying, well, you don't want to fucking give up the game, really, do you? You know, you need to leave enough room for people to approach the book on its own terms. That's what it is. It's just something. It's not mine anymore, you know?
Yeah, absolutely.
And I think the scary thing is, I think the thing that's the weird sort of moment, and you notice yourself, is that I think like, so much about writing is about control, you know, and having control over the material that you have in front of you, and to be able to change whatever it is that you want to change at any point, to improve or to make things clear or whatever.
And
so you're constantly, you don't, so when that control has been relinquished, you're sort of like, you're floundering, you're like, no, it's mine. And that's the bit that's kind of scary, that you can't do anything else to it anymore.
Yeah.
And then you just sort of settle into it. You know, now I'm like at a point where it's kind of, that's it now, and it's grand, and it's its own thing, and I have to sort of try and talk about it in a way that's like, because a lot of the way people talk about writing or about books is about your intention behind what it is that you've done. You're like, I didn't intend on hugging anything.
I
hope for the best. Yeah. That's a very long-winded and complicated way of saying it's coming out. So
it is. There's nothing you can do to stop it.
You know, people are going to say things about it, and you have to kind of just say, okay. You know, the hope is that people will engage on it on good terms and in good faith, and it'll resonate with them in some way. And if they do have something to say about it, that it's something that's, you know, that's not said flippantly or you
of course,
know,
yeah,
you know, that's the hope. But, you know, who the fuck knows?
It's great, so you don't have to really any sleepless nights.
No more sleepless nights.
No more sleepless nights. But I just want to ask you, when you were, I'm always curious about this with writers, and I feel like when I go back and I read a first book, like you were saying about Annie Ernaux there, I read Americana by Don DeLillo recently, and I was saying that everything he subsequently went on to write about, it's all in the first book, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
And I even felt that with my own novel. When I read over it, I was like, oh, of course, like every single thing that I've ever written a bit before is all here, even though I thought I was doing something totally different and new. And it's just, you're constant, like I feel like everything that you will write about is probably already there, and it's surprising to... Did you feel the same way when you were
when the book sold, the question was asked, you know, what are you going to do next? You know, and you have to say what you're going to do. And so you make something up, you know, but I did my instinct. And this it is exactly what you're saying. My instinct is to go backwards, you know.
Yeah.
And I think the next book I write, at least the one I'm planning to write, who knows if it'll come to fruition? Like, but the is that I'll write about childhood, you know, and it'll be about a lot of, and it's clear as day that it will be about that. A lot of the things that are already mentioned in the book, or at least things that are alluded to in the book.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think like it goes back to what Ernaux does and what a lot of writers do, like I think you're sort of constantly excavating the past in some way, if that's what you're preoccupied with, like, or excavating, like, or even if it's not about the past, it's the self, you know, you're constantly trying to come to terms with or get your head around what it is that you're trying to say. And because, like, also, like, you know, when you get to the end of writing a novel, or at least in my experience of writing one novel, you sort of feel like there's still a lot to say. You know, or you haven't said everything that you feel like you needed to say, or you haven't explored everything you feel like you need to explore, or whatever. And so I think it's probably an inch. And I think there's some writers that are like, there's some novelists who write all sorts of things, and I admire that. I admire someone who's constantly going back. But I feel like that's probably what I'm. That's a sort of the way I'm going, I'm itching to go. Like I'm ready to start writing the next one. Have you started writing the second one? Or are you like, you hungover?
Yes. No. I've started. It's very good so far. Dross, I have to say.
I think you'll get it in one draft this time.
I think I could get this one done in about 2 or 3 weeks.
6 months at a push. My goodness, do you know?
Oh God, it's torture. Yeah. Anyway, Mick, I could talk to you all day, but I should go.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having me on. It's been an absolute joy. All right.
Yeah. And it was lovely to talk about Louise's great story, which is available to read on the website.
Thank you. All right, see you in a bit.
Thank you for listening. Thank you to the Arts Council for the support, and we'll see you again soon.